This is going to be Daniel's day, because I have a few words to say about Daniel as well. And I would like to even look at what I've done. I've made up five different reasons why I believe that Christ's return is near, and I'm going to work my way towards that. But first of all, I have some general comments about Nebuchadnezzar's image. We'll get to that part in a second. But in Daniel 2:31, we know, as Tommy was talking, that I don't think he got to 31, but he saw a great image. And the great image stood before him in brightness, and the form thereof was terrible. Its individual metals symbolized historic powers which controlled the then known world. And that's what we need to understand. The book of Daniel is symbolic. The beast and the metals and all of these things symbolize a worldly power, especially a worldly power that is contrary to the nation of Israel and to the saints. And our Creator has blessed our understanding of Daniel's and John's prophecy by actually naming three of these empires. And Nebuchadnezzar is called the king of Babylon. We know that in Daniel 1, chapter 1, verse 1. And in Daniel 8, 20 and 21, I want to read that just to... I think it's important to understand these things. See, we're not just guessing on these things. The scriptures tell us who these people are. So in 20 and 21, the ram which thou sawest having two horns are the kings of Media and Persia. And the rough goat is the king of Grecia. And the great horn that is between his eyes is the first king. And so therefore, when we know these things, we know those kingdoms. We see three kingdoms there. You know, Babylon and Medo-Persia and Greece. We know the empire that took over Greece was Rome in 30 B.C. Basically, Rome overthrew Greece. So therefore, we see that, don't we? There's no questions what we're talking about when we're talking about the book of Daniel, because it gives it by name. If it didn't give it by name, we might have some misunderstandings, but we have no misunderstandings. We know exactly who these four world empires are. And what I want to note here is that the head of gold was conquered by the breast and arms of silver. We know that. And the breast and arms and silver, which was Medo-Persia, was overtaken by the belly and thighs of brass, which we know was Greece, as we have just noted. And we know that the brass empire was overthrown by the Iron Kingdom, and the Iron Kingdom, we know very clearly, had to be Rome. So, the rulers of the kingdom of men do not have to be the same type or the same ethnic race, but one thing stands out above all these powers. They must have been weaned on Babylon's doctrines. And they must epitomize man's opposition to God's truth and to Israel. This is the whole key. So therefore, it doesn't matter where they are exactly located, because we know that Rome is not located where Babylon historically was. See, that doesn't matter. Now, the doctrines of each have been infused into the religious and into the political and moral bloodstream. And a word that perfectly describes this mingling is syncretism. Just think about this a minute. This is a word that's not as hard as it sounds. In a religious sense, syncretism can be defined as follows: the reconciliation, union, or mingling of different forms of faith and worship. The accretion or a growing together of tenets, rites, etc., from those religions which are being superseded. So you can see then that the Babylonian head passed on its doctrines to the Medo-Persian silver. The Medo-Persians then passed what they had learned from Babylon and what they had interjected into it and passed it on down to Greece. And Greece did the same thing and passed it on down. And so when we get to the bottom picture here, we see four world empires, but we also see a fifth element. And I'm going to talk about that fifth element in a minute. Now, one thing that's important about this image is that It's never stood before. It cannot stand on its feet until those feet have been formed. And the feet have not been formed yet. That's very important to realize. And it can't, the stone power cannot hit that image yet because it has not stood before the earth in its all of its power. Now, Brother Thomas was real good at showing what this image really was and what it represented. He said in these words, as a whole, it was a great Assyrian dominion. The head, if you look in Daniel 7, we will note it. Let's look in Daniel 7 real quick. I'm going to be shifting back and forth to Daniel 7 here as well. In verse 4, the first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. This is the Assyrian. This is not the Babylonian. This is the Assyrian. This is the Assyrian military aspect of the Babylonian Empire, of which Nebuchadnezzar eventually became the king of, and he was Babylonian. So therefore, what we see then in this image, the first king was the military force. The second was the ecclesiastical. And that's the order we will see in the latter day. This is antitypically in the latter day. We will see the latter day Assyrian will support the Pope back in the West. That's as simple as that. Is that understandable, everybody? I mean, that's exactly what we're saying. And this is very much proven by Daniel 7. To show again, I've got other proofs, but and look at Daniel 7, verse 7. And this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast. And Tommy mentioned this fourth beast. The beast is so terrible, it's hard to understand because it's a mingling, it's a synchronization of all of those empires rolled into one beast at the last. He's got all those teachings and tenets all wrapped up in it. Therefore, the beast is hard to describe as what it is. And behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, and he would be terrible, strong exceedingly, and it had great iron teeth. Well, that identifies it real quickly, its Roman aspect. It devoured and brake in pieces and stamped the residue with the feet of it, and it was diverse from all the other beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. So we see this is Roman, and it had 10 horns. But let's go further. Let's go over to verse 19. Then I would know the truth of the fourth beast, which was diverse from all the others, exceeding dreadful, whose teeth were of iron, and his nails of brass, which devoured, brake in pieces, and stamped the residue with its feet. And of the 10 horns that were on its head, and one of the others came up before whom 3 fell, even of that horn that had eyes in the mouth that spake very great things, whose look was more stout than his fellow. I beheld, and this same horn made war with the saints and prevailed against them. So therefore, we had an additional aspect here. We had the brass feet. The iron was Roman. The brass, as we know, is Greek. So we have the latter day fourth beast will have Greco-Roman inheritance, a Greco-Roman inheritance. And not only that, a little horn will come up, and this little horn which comes up is none other than the Pope, who is the ecclesiastical power of this fourth beast. So these are the things that we're looking to see. And 324, Constantine was the emperor of the empire, of the Roman Empire. And guess what? He was born in what was previously known as Yugoslavia. He was not a Western man. He was born in Yugoslavia, but he came across the Adriatic Sea, you know, and he took over the Roman Empire from Rome, Italy. And when he took that over, being an Eastern man, he decided, well, look, I'm going to move that empire over to Constantinople. Because it really wasn't Constantinople, it was Byzantium at that time. But he changed the name of Byzantium to Constantinople. The Turks, when they overtook it in 1453, they changed it to Istanbul. So that's what it's known as today, Istanbul. And so therefore, we had a moving of the Greco-Roman influence to Constantinople. So Constantinople has a Greco-Roman influence. It's Grecian-oriented anyway from its location, but the Roman aspect was added unto it, so it has Greco-Roman roots in the east. It did at the time of Constantine, up until the Ottoman Turks took it over. Now, you know, this Assyrian empire, so to speak, and historians will look, when they look at that Babylonian empire, they really many of them would refer to it as the Assyrian, because it was first of all more logically known as the Assyrian Empire. It was, Nebuchadnezzar came along in 604. The Assyrian Empire was overthrown, well, I mean, it overthrew Israel in about 722, 721 B.C. So we see it was still a few more than 100 years later. But Brother Thomas writes that the first king of the head was Babylonish, and so will the last king be likewise. The first was literally and typically head of Babylon's dominion, a city or metropolis which was the beginning of the Assyrian monarchy, and so named because there the confusion of human speech began. The last of Assyrian kings is literally and antitypically head and feet of the empire of the latter days. In other words, in the latter days, when that image stands, that head will have Assyrian, it first of all will be Assyrian, because the Russian Gog will be in control of that empire. The feet, when you look at the feet, the Russian will be in the feet as well. The Gog will be in the feet in the form of the clay. That's what will make that image to stand. When you think of metals, we're not thinking of metals as being hard and the clay as weak. What we're thinking of is that the metals were more valuable at the top, meaning that Nebuchadnezzar was a king, solely a king ahead of that. But as you come down, these metals get of lesser value as you go down. It doesn't mean they get of lesser strength. You get down to the clay, you think that means less strength, but it's not. It just means that clay is symbolic, I think, of man, of the earth, earthy, sinful, but very powerful, because the clay will be what puts these feet together. Let's look at Habakkuk, and I want to note this. And this is a description of this latter day Assyrian and the feet. And in verse 5, yea, also, because he transgresseth by wine, he is a proud man, neither keepeth at home, who enlargeth his desire as hell, and is as death, and cannot be satisfied, but gathereth unto him all nations, and heapeth unto him all people. Shall not all these, meaning Gog's nations, take up a parable against him, and a taunting proverb against him, and say, woe to him that increaseth that which is not his, how long? That's probably speaking of the ones that Gog overthrows. And to him that ladeth himself with thick clay. This is speaking of that latter-day Assyrian, that one in the feet that allows that image to stand. And it won't stand until that image takes up his place in that power. And not only that, he will have in concert with him the West, as the European Union is now developing, and as the Pope is behind the scene in all of these transactions with the European Union, and the Pope will at that time bow to the great power in the East, which is Russia. But we know that when Russia is sundered off of that image, when the stone hits that image and knocks that Russian in the feet and destroys that, we know then that what's left is the Babylonian, the religious section of this of Daniel's empire here, and this religious section will come against Christ and his saints, because he will have the armies behind him of Europe and such. And this is what we see. This is the way we realize that in history the Assyrian was destroyed before the Babylonian, and in our time period the Assyrian will be destroyed first, typified by the historic Assyro-Babylonian, the Assyro-Babylonian will be destroyed in that order in our day as well. I'm trying to cover a lot of territory here, but what I wanted to say about this image, though, don't look upon these legs. Look upon these legs more in the sense of being one dominion, because this is not separate dominions. This is all one dominion together, even though it's made up of five different parts. Now, I'm not telling you that there's not a leg. A leg could be pointing to the east and one to the west. But what I'm saying is, Brother Thomas said, it's more depicting an autonomous union of one power of five different substances. That's what he's saying. That's why when you get to the feet, five in the east and five in the west, it doesn't make any sense, because that's what people today are really complaining about. Well, there's the five in the east are Muslims and whatever, but you can't say that, because we know that there was 10 barbarian nations that formed Europe. And some will say, well, yeah, but there's more than 10 nations there now. That doesn't matter. There's still 10, their heritage is those 10 barbarian nations. It doesn't matter how many countries, there may be 25 countries there, but they still inherited from those 10 barbarian nations. The Goths, the Visigoths, the Burgundians, the Gepids, and so on. All of those were the ones that formulated the European nation. Is that pretty clear to everyone? I hope. Did I go too fast? But anyway, I've got five events I want to kind of look at. I don't know how much time I'll have to get through these, but I may have to cut it short. But I wanted to give a little bit of a background here. Number one, the rise of the latter-day Assyrian, that being Russia. All you have to do is look at the newspapers, and you can see very much what's happening now. You can see Putin, the head of Russia, who's a former KGB agent. And I've got a magazine here, Putin's People. It says there, the spies who run Russia, the KGB, he's a KGB agent through and through, and all of his people that he has behind him are KGB agents. And if you want to act like the man that ran the Russian oil company, guess where he is now? He's in Siberia in a prison somewhere, and probably under the ground somewhere, because the oil revenues have been taken over by the Kremlin. And he's utilizing this great hoard of money. You can realize oil's hit $100 a barrel. What do you think the Russians are making off of that? Incredible amounts. They are rearming to the teeth. They are threatening everyone now. They are arming Iran as well, and we'll get to that in a minute. But I've already looked at Daniel 7, 7 and 19:20, but I want to look at mention a couple of other things. How does Russia relate to the iron influence of the feet and toes and the legs? Is she related to the brass at all? Does she have Greco-Roman influences? That's the question. And does she possess the Catholic faith, civilization, and sympathy? She is known as an Eastern Catholic nation, not Western. But, you know, that will undoubtedly change quite a bit later. Geography and economy made contacts between Russians and Byzantines inevitable since the very inception of Russia as a state and a nation. The adoption of Byzantine Christianity was a fact of free choice of the Russians. G. Ostrogorsky writes that since the adoption of Christianity as the state religion of the Kievan Principality, this was in 988 AD, the influence of Byzantine civilization upon Russia became the determining factor of Russian civilization. The very extent and character of this influence should be understood in the light of three main elements whose combination determined the life of Byzantine society: the Roman political tradition, the Greek literary heritage, and the Orthodox Christian faith. Without all three, the Byzantine way of life would have been inconceivable, writes Mr. Ostrogorsky. This is quoted from Byzantium and the Rise of Russia by John Meyendorf. These people all know Russian history very well, and I've got a number of books and things on this, and I can tell you certainly that they have the Greco-Roman influence to a great degree, much greater than people even mention or know about. Here's a quote from Dmitry Oblinsky, Russia's Byzantine heritage. He says, Russia owes her religion and the greater part of her medieval culture to the Byzantine Empire, or the Eastern Roman, both directly through her connections with Constantinople in the 9th and 10th centuries, and indirectly through the Slavo-Byzantine schools of the 10th century Bulgaria. Byzantium brought to Russia her five gifts: her religion, her law, her view of the world, her art, and writing. This is once again from Mr. Oblinsky. I hope you can understand what we're saying here. This is important. You know, some people would say, well, how could Russia be involved with this? They don't have, you know, they don't have that. They have the Greco-Roman influence to a great degree. You look at their architecture, you can see the Greek influences in all their architecture. You look at Moscow and the way they have all those spires and things. You can see all of that. Russia is one of the main things that Russia wants to do, I think, is take over Turkey. That's one of her great... I've got the will of Peter the Great here. I probably read this before here, but I want to read a couple of these things. Number two, draw unto you by all possible means from the civilized nations of Europe, captains during war and learned men during peace, so that Russia may benefit by the advantages of other nations. Take care to mix in the affairs of all Europe, and in particular Germany. Now, who's Germany? None other than Magog, as Ezekiel 38 notes. Let's see. Marry Russian princes with German princesses, and that's happened in history. Multiply these alliances, unite these interests, and by the increase of our influence, attach Germany to our cause. Already have done that. Germany gets a large percentage of her gas and oil from Russia. Guess what? And a German winter, you're not going to say, well, Russia, we're not going to be with you anymore. Because if you've ever been to Germany, I think Kathy has, they got real cold winters over there. Number nine, I'm skipping just to get a few of these very important ones here. Do all in your power and approach closely Constantinople and India. Remember that he who rules over these countries is the real sovereign of the world. Keep up continued wars with Turkey and with Persia. Huh? Establish dockyards in the Black Sea. Gradually obtain the command of the sea as well as the Baltic. This is necessary for the entire success of our projects. Hasten the fall of Persia. Open yourselves a route towards the Persian Gulf. Reestablish as much as possible by means of Syria the ancient commerce of the Levant, and thus advance towards India. Once there, you will not require English gold. Carefully seek the alliance of Austria. Make her believe that you will second her in her projects for dominion over Germany. And secretly stir up the jealousy of other princes against her, and manage so that such be disposed to claim the assistance of Russia, and exercise over each a sort of protection which will lead the way to future dominion over them. I could keep on going here for as long as... One other thing, I noted that Brother Aaron Thomas wrote, quoted from something he takes, the Stratford, which is a... gives current events. I'm going to read it something real quickly here on that. He says, this says in this, he printed this back in 2003, I think, but Russia and Europe appear to be joining forces to counter the U.S.'s increasing global presence by trying to create greater Europe that would consist of the European Union and Commonwealth of Independent States. Russia has changed the vector of the post-Soviet region's integration process from pro-Moscow to pro-Europe. And having Russia as its most important ally, Europe will encourage post-Soviet states to unite and join the group in an attempt to create the world's new power center. Can we see the importance of that? If we can't, we're not watching. This is exactly what Brother Thomas spoke about, you know, more than 100 years ago. And we're seeing it today. These things are happening right before us. The next thing is Iran. That's a terrible thing. I may skip that point right there in a minute, but I want to speak about the UN just a second. I've done this before in Conway, I know, a number of times, but I really believe the UN is a vehicle for bringing all this about, and I'll give you the reason why. Reading from Zechariah 14, verses 1 and 2. I may not read quite all of it, but behold, the day of the Lord cometh, and thy spoils shall be divided in the midst of thee. For I will gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle. That's important, because we're seeing that now. And the UN is one of the prime instigators of this. I believe that this gathering of nations is now taking place. The all in this verse applies specifically to the Babylonian nations, especially the Mediterranean countries, or from the Atlantic to the Urals. You know, that was Charles de Gaulle. That was one of Charles de Gaulle's favorite sayings. We want to form a Europe from the Atlantic to the Urals. And now, since then, a number of others, Gorbachev said it, and so on. And Putin probably believes it as well. I also believe that the United Nations is playing a significant role in strategically aligning the combatants, the fourth beast nations, against the Tarshish powers or the mother lion and her young. I've got three books that I took some quotes from. I don't know if I'm going to have time to read everything, but I didn't even bring that book. I sure would. That's one thing I forgot. That's one of the quotes I really wanted to read, but one of the things is, basically, if I can just summarize it, the UN believes that Israel needs to be stopped, that she is the prime motivator of non-peace and such, and the UN is out to 30% of the UN's sanctions since its inception have been directed at Israel. But here's a country of probably 5 million people or so. And back then, when it first started, it was less than 5 million, probably somewhere around, even in the 2 million range. 30% of her sanctions were against Israel. Can you believe that? Some of these are so incredible that it's hard to believe. In his book, Inside the Asylum, which was Dor Gold, G-O-L-D. He stated that the UN has become a tool for outlaw nations, their European trading partners, and the tin pot dictators of the world to constrain American action everywhere. The UN not only turns a blind eye to terrorism, but it is actually quite comfortable with it, admitting terrorists to the community of nations, tolerating their development of nuclear weapons, and putting members of terrorist organizations on its payroll. You can see this. The UN has its flag right next to Hamas's flag right on the border of Israel there. It's just the way they are. The UN has never defined terrorism because they don't want to offend a lot of their people that on their payroll, like Hamas and so on. The UN's oil for food program, you remember that a few years back? They allowed Saddam Hussein to skim billions of dollars to buy arms, to buy UN Security Council votes, and to bribe politicians and UN officials at the highest level. Some of the bribed countries were this. Russia received about 1.4 billion barrels of oil. French banks handle $50 billion in oil for food transactions. and also 11 French individuals and companies received benefits from them. And some even say that President Jacques Chirac received kickbacks, French president, and also the son of UN Secretary Kofi Annan received monies from it. These people were all made rich by their activities here. This was as crooked a program that was ever invented. Israel's ambassador to the U.S., Daniel Ayalon, stated that in the international courts of justice, there is an attempt to bring Israel to trial because of self-defense measures that they took because of Palestinian terrorist attacks. But the International Court of Justice will not try terrorism. And why not? Because they even refuse to officially define what terrorism is. Yasser Arafat was the UN's favorite terrorist. He addressed the UN in 1974 and stated, "The old world is crumbling before our eyes as imperialism, colonialism, neocolonialism, and racism, the chief form of which is Zionism, inevitably will perish." He said he was a revolutionary and his opponents were the terrorists. He was the biggest terrorist of all. He put more people to death than we can even imagine. Documents seized by the Israeli army showed that Saddam Hussein was funding terrorism against Israel through the Palestinian Authority. Money to support these activities were also donated by Iran, Syria, and Saudi Arabia, and most of the money was handled by the current PA leader, Abbas. So we have Abbas over there now working out peace negotiations. But anyway, I could go on with this, but... One of the ones that really aggravated me was when in the 1975 debate, the UN General Assembly debated a resolution that declared that Zionism is racism, and one of the most vocal of the opponents was Idi Amin. If you remember him, the head of Uganda, he killed I don't know how many millions of people he put to death. But anyway. Speaking to the General Assembly, without a boo to be heard, Amin called for Israel's expulsion from the UN and for the extinction of Israel as a state. The Zionism as a racist revolution was passed by a vote of 72-35 with 32 abstentions. Think about that a minute. It was singled out, and this was an amazing thing. They, like I said, 30% of their sanctions have been against Israel. But, you know, I've got so many things I can tell you about. But another that was the second one. The third one is peace and safety. When they shall say peace and safety, then sudden destruction. All I have to say about this is now President Bush has stated that he's going to spend the rest of his time trying to make sure that there's a peace treaty over there between the Palestinians and Israel. We know that that's what's being worked on. Now, whether it will be time for that or not, I don't know. But let me say this. When a peace treaty is made, we better be ready to go. So that's what I'm saying, how close we are. It's close. It's really close. It may not happen yet. But when it does, we know that Ezekiel 38 says that Israel is in peace and safety, so to speak, at the time when God comes down. Then sudden destruction is in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. That's what it's talking about. We have to be very prepared for this. I'm not going to say a whole lot more about that, but even Olmert, the prime minister of Israel now, is saying how much Israel needs peace. They're willing to bargain away some of their land in order to have peace. But the problem is, and Joel, the prophet Joel, has mentioned this as well, this land is not theirs. They are leaseholders. Israel leases the land now. It hasn't been granted to them as an everlasting possession yet. They are leaseholders. They are not freeholders, as Brother Thomas noted in Elpis Israel. And so, therefore, when Israel tries to bargain, it's just like if you own some houses and you had some people leasing some houses for you, and they went ahead and sold those houses, what would you think? How would you feel? Would you be a little angry? What do you think the Almighty is when they're over there trying to give away or sell his land that's not theirs to give? You know, that's why I believe that God will come down. That will be the last reason for God to come down, because the Almighty will punish them for that. See, the town of Jericho, you know how important that town is? It's no longer in Israeli hands. The Muslims have it. You know, and look at the West Bank. It's, you know, about half and half, and now Gaza is gone. It's not theirs anymore. We know that the land given in Genesis chapter 15 goes, verse 18 goes all the way from the Nile to the Euphrates. That land is all there going to be theirs. And here they are giving away the central parts of it. Yeah, you can see why the Almighty is going to react. Time's wasting. I want to mention a few things about the EU. This is another thing. Looking at the EU, I won't be able to say much here, but we know that in what's happening now, the EU is really developing. We know that they have their own currency now, the euro dollar, and that was passed, I think, on January the 1st, 2002. That's a monumental affirmation of Bible prophecy, because there's an old saying or economic principle that if you once control the currency, you control the economy. And if you control the economy, you control the country. And this is basically what's happening. When you're on that euro, you're not going to get off of it. And basically, the leaders are going to control you, because they actually have control of the currency. And that's what's happened. Now, what we need to understand is too, that after this, not only has this euro, but their constitution was just passed not too long ago. The constitution was affirmed, and so they have a strict constitution, and their laws are so onerous, and I mean so burdensome, that you can't afford to do too many things out of line. You got to stay pretty much in line with that constitution, or they'll wear you down with all types of regulations and such. So that's what's happening. I've got all kinds of articles on that, and I'm not going to have time to go into that. But I want to mention something about the Pope. It has been estimated by careful and credible historians that more than 50 million of the human family have been slaughtered by the crime of heresy by popish persecutors, an average of more than 40,000 religious murders for every year of the existence of popery. The scripture speaks prophetically of her lust for power and blood, and history has recorded many of the gruesome details. The papacy has been predominant throughout the whole history of Europe. It has left its mark and record on most of the major nations. In times past, it has proven itself to be totally dominant in its control of kings and princes. But the thing about Europe today, though, is this, that the Vatican operates through its civil ambassadors in each European nation. According to the Catholic Almanac, papal representatives receive from the Roman pontiff the charge of requesting him in a fixed way, representing him in a fixed way in the various nations or regions of the world. Secondly, the Roman Church also deals directly and legally with individual nations through its many legal concordats. And less directly, it operates through its representation and influence in most of the governmental agencies of Europe. I don't need to say much more than that. But behind the EU is the Pope. He's very much there, and he works in secret. That's the way the Pope has worked, is in secret. The last one I was going to mention is Iran. You know that the ultimate objective of the Iranian leader, Ahmadinejad, He called Israel a rotten, dried tree that will be annihilated by one storm at a conference. He said, like it or not, the Zionist regime is heading toward annihilation. His response to the nations of the world who are concerned that they are making nuclear weapons to attack Israel and America is as follows. Our answer to those who are angry about Iran achieving the full nuclear cycle is in one phrase. We say, be angry and die of this anger. His tirade against Israel has made it clear that he intends to use nuclear weapons against the Jewish state. There is no doubt that the new wave of attacks in Palestine will soon wipe off this disgraceful blot from the face of the Islamic world. Israel must be wiped off the map. And he also, in his tirades, flatly denies that the Holocaust ever happened. And that is in all of the Iranian newspapers now, that never even happened. That's just a bunch of hooey. Well, my dad helped liberate one of those camps. And it makes me furious when people say that. My dad wouldn't even talk about it. He couldn't stand it. You know, it was horrible. It was worse than you can see. You can see these movies and pictures of it. There ain't nothing like being there. That smell was just, you just can't believe it. And that's why Israel is very afraid. Because of Iran right now, they're extremely afraid. Because not only are they afraid of the nuclear possibility, but they are afraid of the threat of the nuclear possibility will keep businesses and things from coming to Iran that will ruin their economy. That's another thing they're very fearful about. I've got a whole article on that, but I could read a lot of that if you'd like it. I want to show, I'm not going to be able to, I didn't show many maps, but I want to show this. I'm not too well organized here. It took a while to put all this together, but I want to read you something from talking about Iran. On page 12 of the exposition of Daniel, I want to make this point clear. Just a little short reading. The latter-day symbol then of Persia, and we know this is a bear, and that's what the scripture tells us. And a bear is at this time her formidable neighbor and has already taken her from her a large portion of her territory, the Russian bear. Russia is also known as the bear. I think you probably know that. The Russian bear is destined to supersede her present government as an independent sovereignty and to grasp Persia between its teeth from near India to Ethiopia, which is to be at its steps. This is no mere conjecture, but absolutely certain. For Yahweh declared by Ezekiel that Persia shall be an element of Gog's confederacy and that Gog is the Russian power will be seen when I come to treat with the king of the north at the time of the end. So, but anyway, that's important to understand. There is the territory. I don't know if, does that show, can you see that well enough? That's the territory that Brother Thomas says that will be in the hands of the Russian God. And look at all of that. You see, it comes right over here to near India. That's where the Indus River is. That was the limits, the eastern limits of the Persian Empire. This over here, it was the western limits of the Roman Empire. All of those empires there had territories, and all these territories are incorporated within that big circle. Although parts of the territory, Russia is the only thing in there that, you know, that probably there was some Persian, some of this territory, I think, this probably should have been drawn a little bit up here, because some of that territory did go up into parts of Russia. I didn't do it there. I just circled it real quick. But part of that territory, the Persian Empire, went into Russia. So, and we know that a lot more has been added by the huge area there of Russia. Because Russia is almost 8,000 miles across. That's a huge territory. One other map I'll show the Persian. If I can get it out here real quick. Trouble with me and my can't find my maps half the time. I look forever. I can't find it now. Who knows? Well, I didn't put it in there. But anyway, as I showed you, the Persian Empire went over to here, and it went over to near Greece. Greece on here is right about here. So it went a long way. And anyway, just want to make a concluding remark here. I'm about to run out of time here. But, you know, we need to be especially, I think, careful. The warning to us is to take heed. Remain constantly on guard. And this is words from, let's look at Luke 21. I'll look at Luke 21. It's better for me to read it directly. Speaking of the latter times, and they shall fall by the edge of the sword, and shall be led away captive into all nations, and Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles, until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. And there shall be signs in the sun, in the rulers, and in the moon, you know, or the ecclesiastical aspects, and the stars, or the statesmen, and upon the earth, are the common people. Distress of nations with perplexity, the sea and the waves roaring, or the nations basic and the peoples basically being in turmoil. Men's hearts failing them for fear. Do you think we see that today? And for looking after those things which are coming on the earth, for the powers of heaven shall be shaken. And then shall they see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. They, the nations, will not see that until after the judgment seat and the saints have, and Christ has come. They won't see Christ come. The Babylonian system won't see it at all. He comes as a thief. And he may come as a thief to us if we're not mentally awake and prepared. But and when these things begin to come to pass, look up and lift up your heads, for your redemption draweth nigh. We know the parable of the fig tree, you know, that summer is now nigh at hand. And I think we're just about in July, I think. Of summer, you know, the hot weather. We're just about to get to the hot weather. It says, and then heaven and earth shall not pass away in verse 33, but my word shall not pass away. And then it says in 34, and take heed to yourselves, lest at any time your hearts be overcharged with surfeiting, or the diglot has gluttony, and drunkenness, and cares of this life, so that they come up on you unawares. For as a snare shall it come on all them that dwell on the face of the whole earth. Watch ye therefore, and pray always, that ye may be accounted worthy to escape all these things that shall come to pass, and to stand before the Son of Man. That's where we are, brothers and sisters. It behooves us to put our mind to all of this, very much so. I think what we'll do now is have our memorial hymn. I think that's enough words for me. 150.